This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
All right, Todd, we ready?
Okay.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Ruttinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking all politics all the time, Jay. It has been a really interesting week and promises to be a very interesting week to come. The big news of the week is about the Senate of the U.S. being potentially in play politically, and that's something of interest. And the other is that, of course, we've got a hurricane bearing down on the east coast of the country.
Yeah, well, in terms of the hurricane, Hurricane Florence has now been downgraded, I guess, to a Category 3. It's supposed to hit somewhere on the coast of the Carolinas and create massive damage. We taped this show a little bit early, so we don't know the full extent of the damage, but our prayers and hopes and wishes are for the folks in Carolina, Georgia, coastal area. Make sure to stay safe and try to stay out of harm's way.
Well, we in Houston know how serious these things
are.
Yeah,
we do. We definitely do. But Brandon, I'm interested kind of on the politics side of sort of hurricane politics.
That's we
know that the president says that FEMA is ready, but a report came out. Senator Jeff Merkley out of Oregon just released a memo that stated that the Trump administration had transferred nearly $10 million from FEMA to Immigration and Customs Enforcement to deal with the influx and greater expenditures related to the change in policy. And the president has got himself in hot water by claiming that the almost 3,000 people who died in Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria, that that's not even true, that they did a great job down there and only something like 3 to 6 people passed away is what he's claiming.
Yeah. The optics of the Puerto Rico trip, as you recall, were quite bad for the president, right? This is where he was like shooting free throws of paper towels into the crowd. I think that he has gotten better at the comforter-in-chief role. He has, I think, over the course of the last couple of weeks, honed that a little bit. Part of it, of course, is just image making, but part of it is that I think that you have to kind of breathe in the presidency. So after and during the 9/11 remembrances, that I think is maybe a good sign for the White House that they can have this as something that they can use as a moment of unity for the country. But like you say, this is a really difficult time, and there are so many ways that this can go wrong. And if the recovery efforts go in a negative direction, then it's going to magnify the effect on the White House as well as the people on the ground. So it's definitely something to watch. And we hope that, frankly, the politics of this doesn't get in the way of the recovery, which is the critical part.
Well, that's the thing to me. It's like the politics, I think, really are a big part of this. And you know, the transference may not matter, but it can matter in the perception of in the minds of people. The issues surrounding, you know, how effective they were in Puerto Rico doesn't really matter in the context of Florence, but it does matter in the minds of people because, again, you know, it makes you wonder about how prepared FEMA really is. Is the president really on top of the situation? We know that we're in a campaign cycle. We know that the stakes are very high. And that's one of the reasons why sort of the two big dogs are out on the campaign trail. President Bush and President Obama are doing something you don't normally see. Not one, but two former presidents are out there stumping for their respective parties.
That's right. In fact, I don't think we've ever had a time in history where we've had this many ex-presidents alive at once. And so, not surprisingly, they're going to get involved in the politics of this. In particular, George W. Bush is spending some time in the Lone Star State. He's doing fundraisers in Fort Worth for the North Dakota Senate candidate, and then hosting a fundraiser in Dallas for Pete Sessions, who has a pretty tough fight against Colin Allred in the eastern part of Dallas. This is interesting to me. When George W. Bush left office, he was about as popular as a wet shoe, right? It was like the popularity was in the 30s, right? And now the numbers are like double that in the 60s. So he has rebounded his popularity in part because of the reflection of Trump, who a lot of people look at as being somebody who is not taking care of the office and doesn't use the office the way that other presidents have. So I think that's interesting. But I don't know. I'm probably like a lot of other Dallasites who will never forgive George W. Bush for trading Sammy Sosa from the Rangers, thereby dooming the Rangers to obscurity for more than a couple of decades. So this is good, I think, though, for Republicans, right? Like, and for Democrats, too, frankly, with Obama. What do you think?
No, I think it's a good thing for Republicans with George W. Bush. As you said, he's done a great job sort of rehabilitating his poll numbers and his general sort of popularity. I think it's more telling who he's not campaigning for. Mm-hmm. He could help Ted Cruz get reelected in Texas. George W. Bush is wildly popular in Texas. We know that, and there's bipartisan popularity for him. But he famously is not a fan of Senator Ted Cruz. And so he is not here, and that's one of the reasons why they need Donald Trump to try to help. But and you reference that, right? He lives in the district that is currently represented by Pete Sessions, and that's one of the reasons why he is out there trying to support his candidacy.
Right.
And he's as you said, he's campaigning for a U.S. Senate candidate in North Dakota.
Right.
So these are not like, you know, it's not a broad range of campaign the way President Obama is,
right,
who's directly sort of taking the fight to Donald Trump, trying to turn out general voters. But as we remember in 2016, he did very much the same thing for Hillary Clinton, but wasn't able to turn out voters. President Obama himself, when he's on the ballot, is inspiring and generates enthusiasm and gets people out to the polls. But when he's not on the ballot, the transit of property in politics isn't as strong, and he just hasn't been as successful in generating that kind of turnout.
Yeah, the same is true for Bernie Sanders, right, whose fundraising capacity doesn't really extend beyond Bernie Sanders. Also, didn't Bernie Sanders' son lose in a primary, right, in Vermont? Like, how is that even possible, given the amount of attention to Bernie Sanders? But like you say, it doesn't always translate. Well, let's talk about immigration, because that's something definitely that's been a major key election point, and we're going to see it, no doubt, too, when we talk more about the Senate races across the nation and in Texas. The Attorney General has announced plans to increase the number of immigration judges by 50% by the end of the year. This comes at an interesting moment where you've got about 400 migrant kids who remain separated from their parents, and you also have a spike in the number of family members arrested for illegally entering the United States, about 38% increase, amounting to about 13,000 people, Jay.
Yeah, 13,000 kids, minors, are currently in detention. That's a record. We have never had that many minors in a detention center before, or in detention right now. Again, this talks about our larger immigration policy, but part of the problem there is that we don't, as you said, we don't have the judges. We don't have the processing capability to deal with it, but the policies that we've done about separation, about detention, is fueling a lot of this. In terms of the judges, it's important to recognize immigration judges aren't real judges in the way we classically think of them. They don't have lifetime appointments.
But they have
not,
robes, right?
They do have robes, but that's actually really a relatively modern thing.
Right.
They're actual employees of the Department of Justice.
Right.
Their boss is Jeff Sessions. And so when Jeff Sessions gets out there and says that immigration judges should show no mercy, that I think can send out a chilling effect. And I think in many ways creates a lack of integrity in the overall process.
Yeah. This has been fumbled from the Trump administration, I think, from the start. We talked about this weeks and weeks ago. They've struggled to reunite families despite the fact that the courts are telling them that they have deadlines to make that happen. And now you've got, again, for the second time, the Attorney General telling these new judges that essentially they should be, and this is from this week, not sympathetic towards people in these situations. So this is something, I think, which potentially undermines the independence of these judges and is highly problematic in terms of the influence in the judiciary. But it's a political issue, right? 22% of the public says immigration is the number one issue, and over a third of Republicans say that's true. So it's playing to the politics of this, which could have long-term implications and very problematic implications.
Well, speaking of fumbling things coming out of the White House, President Trump has been bragging about the economy. We know that the economic growth numbers have been shockingly high over the last two cycles, and we know the unemployment rate is at a record low. The president, I think, mistakenly a couple times has been kind of bragging even more than you're supposed to brag when it comes to the economy.
Right,
citing that this is the first time in history that the growth rate has exceeded the unemployment rate, which is not factually correct. Surprise, surprise. Is this even a big deal, or are we just kind of immune to the P.T. Barnum-esque issues related to the president? He's always kind of talking things up, puffing things up.
Yeah.
Do we just say, hey, you know what? He was just basically saying the economy was good. Why are we holding him to this kind of standard?
tooting your own horn is one thing, right? But this is the horn the size of like Milwaukee, right? Here's where I think the hyperbole hurts the president, right? Where you have bragged that the economy is so good, but it's clear that for not all people it's that good. And the Republicans who, even though they agree that it's good, may not agree that it's that good. And so your expectations are set in such a way as to potentially let down people. And that's a real problem. This is a key issue, right? And we, of course, learned this week that the budget is likely to go forward and the president will sign it. And this is a major factor in a brag point for many Republicans. So the president doesn't want to oversell it. And that runs the risk of being politically damaging.
To me, this is all about credit. The president is not getting credit for the economy. Right. And it's driving him to do these types of things. At the same time, the unemployment rate is a record low and that the growth rate of the economy is at a record high, at least over the last few years, the president's approval rating is consistently below 40%. And that disconnect is something that I think is creating problems for the Trump administration. And the president himself just can't wrap his head around the fact that he thinks things are going so well and nobody really is giving him the credit.
Yeah.
And that he continues to be unpopular.
And then you have President Obama on the trail saying, hey, you don't get to take credit for that, right? But I'll say this. Here's an alternative explanation. Optimism works. We know from research that presidential remarks on the economy that are positive have a positive effect on people's perceptions of economic news, and that has an effect on market conditions. So there is a good reason for him to be this optimistic, but being over-optimistic in that way could be a bit of a downside. Well, let's shift gears and talk Texas, Jay. Now, we are both graduates of the seventh grade in the great state of Texas, so we know full well that we should remember the Alamo. But is it the case that we're going to do that in perpetuity? The State Board of Education has chimed in on this.
Well, we're always going to remember the Alamo. The question is, how do you remember the Alamo, right? So the State Board of Education had a working group committee that looks at sort of the standards, the overall standards, and what you need to learn for each grade. When they came up for social studies, for seventh grade social studies, and as it relates to Texas history, they wanted to look and revisit the wording around what they call the TEKS standards for the Alamo section and remembering the Texas Revolution. And the whole issue is whether or not the defenders of the Alamo should be referred to in the TEKS standard as heroic or not heroic. And a panel of experts had said, applying and using the word heroic is a value judgment. And more to the point, it sort of leads students in a certain direction, and you want them to come to that understanding on their own. It has turned into a bit of a flashpoint, mm-hmm. and they reversed themselves. Governor Abbott got out there and said, no, this is political correctness run amok. George P. Bush said pretty much the same thing. A lot of folks in the GOP thought it was a alteration of history. My take is that this is much ado about nothing.
Yeah, ultimately ended up being nothing. But if there's one thing we've learned in Texas politics, it's you don't mess with the Alamo, right? Or the interpretation of the Alamo as being like a major moment. Now, I love Texas history, and I think the fact is that the Alamo is simply one sliver of it, right? You could talk about all the different battles in the Revolution, many of which were more consequential in some specific way. So I don't want the governor tweeting at me about not remembering the Alamo, but I think the fact is that, yeah, we're talking about like a very small, compact type of unit here. To me, though, obviously, you'd like to be able to have neutral language in all of this, but it's really hard to do. So as someone who writes textbooks, I know that it's difficult to be able to make that. And oftentimes, it's not even on purpose. It's just sort of a way to have flourish with language. But one other part of this, too, is that the governor has actually also tweeted that the controversial requirement that the students learn about Moses and Mosaic Law and the influence of that on the founding documents has potentially to be on the cutting board. And so historians have suggested there's not really evidence of that, and the governor has said that he wants to keep it. So again, we see, you know, not surprisingly, the State Board of Education being, you know, the kind of battleground for all these kinds of fights, right? It's been hip-hop for a while. It's been, you know, the influence of the sort of Texas founders on the rest of the country. It's been, you know, Thomas Jefferson and his influence on Texas and the nation. So there's been a constant battle for this, and this is just a sort of next incarnation of it.
Well, I mean, as the state gets more diverse and it calls for a more comprehensive look at the history of the state comes aboard, this is a natural sort of outcropping of that. And that, to me, is sort of part of it. So as much as we kind of make light of the fact that this seems like a silly thing, It's really about a larger issue. And that larger issue is kind of how are we going to look at ourselves as a state? How are we going to look at the history of the state, the totality of it? And that's really been the criticism of it. The Alamo itself, the explanations of what happened has really changed over time and become more comprehensive in large part because of that diversity.
Yeah, and the history gets rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. In fact, new books have come out that suggest that, yeah, some of the things that Texas did in the time of the Republic and after were highly problematic on the border, violent and basically land robbing. So these things obviously are always in flux, and so that's always going to be fought over. Speaking of being fought over, we have an interesting fight that will, I think, define in some ways the next legislative session over funding for public schools. What's going on?
Well, what's happened actually here is kind of interesting. We know the property values, local property values, are actually rising once again. And the way we fund education in Texas is kind of a linked system where the state contributes and local governments contribute, the local ISD. And what's happened is the way the state law currently reads is the money comes out of the local taxpayer before it's funded by the state. So as local tax receipts rise, the amount of contribution from the state of Texas drops. So we're in this peculiar position of the state portion of funding for education is likely to drop next legislative session unless the legislature acts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and basically TEA's budget or proposed budget says they're going to take less money from like general revenue and have more from the taxed revenue, like you say. This is something the Democrats have been trying to trumpet by saying that the Republicans talk about how they want to reduce property taxes, but the reality is that it's gone up, you know, precipitously under their watch. The other is that, remember, this was the very issue that really was the short circuit for what happened in the special session in 2017. The debate over where or when and how to cap specific taxes and then the sort of resulting questions in revenue was really what undid the Republicans internally and then basically put a kind of a crashing halt to the legislative session. So we'll see how this plays out, but I think that we're going to see that legislation for sure again. I'm just not sure that you're going to see a lot of traction here for Democrats saying that property taxes are going up, right? Everyone realizes this, but no one's giving the Democrats, it seems, credit for trying to say that this is a clear trade-off. I don't know. How do you see it?
Well, I just think that there needs to be fundamental reform on how we fund public education in Texas. And this,
oh, is that all we get?
Yeah. That's a tiny segment in the show. But that really is what the root of this is. I mean, the idea that we're taking money from the local property values before where the state is funding it is kind of a backward system in itself. The state constitution explicitly states the responsibility for public education is in the state of Texas, and it's created sort of this. You know, backwards problem what we have. And as a consequence, unless you reform the whole system, we're always going to be having this problem. Well, Brandon, one of the axioms in politics is you just never help your enemies, right? Your opponents. Well, for some reason, Representative Henry Cuellar from Laredo, who's a Democrat, has decided to get involved to help Republican John Carter from Round Rock against MJ Hager, who is the Democrat. In a very close race, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's interesting. You tend to think of, you know, bedfellows as being partisan, but in this case, the bedfellows is really about power, right? So a big reason why Henry Cuellar has spent time, well, has invited supporters in the district to a fundraiser for John Carter is that they are both on House Appropriations, which is probably the most powerful group of people you don't know about. And getting onto that committee as a Democrat requires serious friendships and probably a lot of flexibility in terms of your partisanship. So Cuellar is a fairly conservative Democrat. He sent out invitations to this breakfast fundraiser for John Carter, who's locked in a pretty serious race, like you say, with MJ Hager. Hager, as you recall, sort of became fairly famous nationwide for some really inventive ads. And so I don't know that this will be a race that the Democrats can flip, but she is giving it her all. And when you talk about quality candidates, I think there's a really good chance that like she could make a real stand there. And if it doesn't work now, it could work in 2020.
Well, I don't understand the politics for Cuellar here. And this is why, because I agree with you. Hager is likely to lose. Carter's likely to get reelected. But if you look at the polling right now, the likelihood that the Democrats will flip the House is over 65%, 70% in some polling. So it looks good for the Democrats to recapture the House. So then Henry Cuellar, if you think about seniority, would likely move up, except for one problem. if he continues to anger his colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle, he could potentially lose a lot of that leverage that he has on House appropriations. So it's a gamble he's making. It's not a very smart move for a guy who has been a pretty crafty politician.
It depends on who's in charge, right? Like if Pelosi is ahead and the policy committee stays the same, then that's really who gets to judge where individual members go in terms of their positions. But if somebody else comes in, maybe they're willing to give Cuellar a chance. We'll see. But this is definitely not making you a lot of friends.
Well, speaking of sort of crafty politicians, Representative Ron Reynolds, who has been generally regarded as a pretty effective and solid Democratic state rep from the Missouri City area, is unfortunately now going to find himself spending potentially a good part of the session in jail, Brandon. He was convicted of barratry, which is essentially the crime of illegally soliciting clients for his law practice. This is a second or third offense in his case. And as a consequence, he was convicted of a misdemeanor crimes, punishable up to a year in prison. They gave him a year in prison, and so he's going to jail.
I don't even know what to say, Jay. It's like confirming every wild fantasy about Texas politics that our corrupt politicians are all, on their way to jail, right? It feels like Molly Ivins was right? That virtue is only found in Minnesota. It's not found in Texas, right? And as you said, as sure as God made prickly pear, this was inevitable that you're going to see corruption. And so, I don't know, maybe it was just a natural outcome, but he's been fighting these charges for years. Here's the thing that surprises me, Jay. He got 61% in his primary. 61% of people in his district, in the primary, Democratic primary, voted for him with a full knowledge that this could happen. So
he was already convicted at the time of the primary.
Right. So, you sort of blame the system, you want to blame the party. I don't think you can. I think in some level you have to blame the voters.
Oh, I agree with that. I think the voters made a conscious choice. They knew that this possibility could occur. When you are convicted of a misdemeanor, not a felony, you do not lose your ability to stay in office. He doesn't have to resign. Yeah. He's going to continue to do this. It just doesn't make any sense from that perspective. But I feel for him. I feel for his family. It's still a year of time on something that most people who have been convicted of never spend a day in jail.
Right.
And so there's a question of sort of the application and the fairness of it. But the bottom line is that district may not have a representative for a good part of the session.
Yeah. Well, speaking of law breaking, the governor has some very key ideas about how to change the structure of law breaking and has decided that it would be a good idea if we ban red light cameras. So what do you think, Jay? Should we ban these red light cameras or what?
So here's my thing on this. And Brandon, you and I have talked about this a lot on the show. We wrote an op-ed in the Chronicle about this. Governor Greg Abbott wants to be not just the governor of Texas, he wants to be the mayor of Texas. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, the governor continues to get involved in local issues over and over and over again. Everything from tree ordinances to plastic bags to fracking in Denton and now red light cameras. He's trying to decide taxi cab ordinances and why Uber and Lyft should be regulated statewide. This is a problem. Texas is a decentralized state. Cities and counties have always had the ability to govern themselves in a meaningful way. And so when we start dealing with red light cameras, what's next? He's going to tell you where you're going to put a stop sign.
Right.
He's going to tell you how often you have to mow your yard.
Yeah.
The governor needs to stop with this.
This is interesting. I think it's a winnable issue for him, though, politically, because he says that these cameras pose a constitutional issue. This is something that trumpets many of the other conservatives who have tried to ban these for a while. So this is a way that he can sort of synergize with his own past, which is obviously the judiciary. But there's also kind of a code switch at work here, right? Now, all the ads he's been running have been these sort of happy, positive ads, right? He's, invest in early education, they fix the foster care system, but then he's got kind of a code switch to these kinds of issues where conservatives can find something to like. So the governor, I think, is playing it really smart here politically, right? Not only is he going to win election by a big margin, but also he's got to be able to govern in the next session. So he's, I think, playing this pretty smart, regardless of all of the implications of what it means.
Look, I guess I should be happy that he's not talking about bathrooms and he's only talking about red light cameras. That probably is coming back.
Senator Colcourt said so.
Yeah. That's right. He's not talking about it, but we know Lieutenant Governor Patrick will.
Yep.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's dive deep and talk about some of these great Senate races Is the U.S. Senate in play, Brandon? Mitch McConnell certainly thinks so. We'll find out right after this.
So, Jay, the big news of the week is that there's a lot of buzz about the U.S. Senate being in play politically, right? The Democrats are defending 10 seats that were carried by Donald Trump in 2016. The Democrats have a path, but a narrow path. So what do you think? What's a big race that you think is going to be on the radar?
Well, let's talk about three big races. Let's talk Arizona, Florida, and finish off with, of course, our home state, Texas.
Sunbelt states,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Sunbelt states. Well, Florida is what let me talk real quickly about that one, and I'll pass the other one on to you. Mm-hmm. Rick Scott, Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson has been there a long time. Former astronaut, generally popular there. Rick Scott is a popular incumbent governor. He's bucking the trend. This is a state that voted for Trump, and he has embraced that. He was a supporter of the president. This is the one state where it looks like it could be a pure pickup, except for one thing, and I think it was trending in that direction. The Democratic nominee for governor surprisingly became Andrew Gillum. Andrew Gillum is an African-American progressive. All of a sudden, the voters in Florida, particularly in South Florida, among the minority community and younger people, are far more inclined to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
That helps Bill Nelson, and I think that's going to be the big surprise.
Mm.
The polling is very, very close now. I'm going to give the edge to Nelson just based on that.
Interesting. Let's talk Arizona. It's hot and dry there. The politics, though, are definitely hot and probably like a little bit steamy. You have here, in the context of this race, this is the seat that's being vacated by Jeff Flake. This is the context that you have with John McCain's passing, right? So I think that there's a sense that maybe finding somebody who has that kind of moderate spirit or really somebody who's willing to work across the aisle and speak their mind is going to be important. So 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I didn't think maybe this was possible, but there's a chance here that there are Democrats could pick this up. You've got, in this case, Democratic Representative Kristen Siema, who is somebody who has tried to cultivate that middle-of-the-road image. She's running against Representative Martha McSally, who has tried to and really had to kind of hug Trump closer in her primary in Arizona, which in the Republican side of things can get pretty conservative. So I think this is going to be a pretty tight race. Polling has it sort of as a toss-up right now. But look, if the Democrats can win in these areas where you've got an increasing percentage of minorities and of younger voters, then that potentially puts other seats in play. It could, you know, potentially put Nevada in play. So this is something where if you see this happening, it could be spell something positive for the future of the Democrats.
Well, let's real quickly talk Texas, and that's the big race right now. Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz.
Never heard of him.
I've never heard of either of them, right? Betomania, I've talked about it a little bit. It's kind of sweeping the state. Is that enough? We know there's a lot of euphoria around him. He's drawing big crowds. The polling is starting to get closer. It is close, particularly for a state like Texas. I'll say this. It's a competitive race, but Cruz should win this race, not by much, probably less than 5 points, 4 points. I think it's probably in some ways a weird little victory for both of them. No one ever imagined Beto O'Rourke would get this close. And Ted Cruz will still likely win. I'll tell you, the guy I should be worried is John Cornyn in 2020 because he will lose to Beto O'Rourke.
That's a good point. The polling here is interesting. Now, the numbers, I think, as you say, give Cruz an edge. You're talking about probably the need for O'Rourke to have something like 2 million votes. That's hard to do. It's definitely the case that the Cruz numbers for voters under 40 and for males are much better, and that's likely to be where most voters are. So if younger voters come out, that could help O'Rourke. If, you know, ethnically diverse voters come out, that's going to help O'Rourke. But typically that doesn't happen. They're going to need like presidential level turnout to make that happen. O'Rourke's fundraising here, though, is really interesting. Here's how it relates to the rest of the country. The more money the Democrats have to or potentially will pour into Texas is less money they can pour into all these other races like Florida and Arizona, like we talked about. So there's a potential that Texas could sort of sap some of that away nationally, and that's a real tough balance.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and our spirit animal, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to Al Ortiz and our digital team. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the big campaign Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.